You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, The Not So Simple Consultation, presented by Dr. Simon Morgan and Dr. Jess Wrigley. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
Welcome all to the Not So Simple Consultation, and that's been deliberately named as such because this is very much around those encounters that I think registrars typically, and sometimes supervisors even, sort of see as pretty straightforward. And we're talking really here in the early weeks and months of a GP registrar's time in practice. They're new to the practice, they've got lots of open appointments, and a lot of these consultations seem relatively straightforward. And indeed, the patients often sort of preface it with, you know, just something simple today. I did a teaching visit a couple of days ago and the patient walked in and said, just a simple script today. And we'll be actually covering that because really lots of these seemingly simple consultations are actually a little bit more or significantly more complex or high risk than we give them credit for. So that's what the focus of the session is on. My name's Simon Morgan. I am a medical educator and a GP, and I'm working in the lands of the Awabakal people here in Newcastle. And yeah, it's a great pleasure to welcome Jess Wrigley along to co-facilitate the webinar tonight.
Hello. I'm also on Awabakal country in Newcastle, and I'm a GP working at the Awabakal AMS and a medical educator with the RACGP, and obviously doing some GPSA education work as well.
Yeah, and great to work with you. I guess this webinar has been born a little bit from a discussion, or many discussions that we've had over the years around observing registrars early in practice, and also getting a bit of a sense of those types of encounters that they have early in the piece. So this is very much a focus on early term registrars, but really applicable to all registrars and indeed to all GPs. And so we're talking about these sort of potentially complex or high risk scenarios that can masquerade as simple ones. And I guess helping to identify those and supporting registrars to navigate them safely and effectively. But a question to you first, what are some of the seemingly simple, and we've alluded to a few of those, but you know, actually a bit more complex or potentially higher risk? What would you identify and maybe even, you know, flag and discuss with the registrar, you know, some of these things that, you know, it seems pretty easy, just sort of in and out, but there's a whole bunch perhaps below the surface that needs to be addressed.
So fatigue is one of them. Oh, and driving medical, excellent. We shall be talking about that in a second. The I just need a blood test. I think it's certainly when the patient thinks it's simple. And then sometimes we're immediately aware this isn't going to be simple. Other times we may be fooled. Insomnia.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fatigue and insomnia.
Centrelink forms. So yeah, forms.
Yep.
UTI. Yeah, so I have another UTI. That's a classic one. Repeat scripts, excellent. Skin lesion, can you check it? Just a script, so common. Medical certificate, yeah, awesome. Oh, well, we're going to cover a few of those. Headache,
yeah. We will. Yeah, no, it's interesting, those undifferentiated presentations, fatigue, insomnia, headache. I think a lot of registrars, for GPs maybe they go, yeah, I've seen so many of these, it's relatively straightforward. Registrars may think, oh, there's a bit here and I do need to be careful. So certainly I think some of those other ones we'll be touching on. And I think a really, really good resource for this is the Call for Help list, which you'd be familiar with. We've talked about it many times on GPSA webinars, and the RSAGP supervisors will also be aware of this as part of EASL. It's a good list, and there's lots of things that are not so straightforward or simple on spec, but down the bottom end certainly are things that, you know, a registrar may say, oh yeah, I think I could deal with that. And you can say, well, you know what, there's quite a bit of content behind them, and maybe you've actually never done these, even though they might look straightforward. When have you ever certified somebody fit to drive, say, or done a formal skin check, or just renewed, you know, long-term medications? But we will start with the, it's certainly been seen as the dreaded driving medical.
The reason I wanted to talk about this, I suppose, is there's just been a run over the last year, I feel, in the ECTVs that I've conducted with registrars getting lots and lots of patients coming in for their driving medicals. And yeah, just a few observations that I'd made and in discussing with other ECT visitors, similar things. So So we'll have a case, first of all, which is a fairly typical case. So we've got Dawn, 76. She comes in, she's not very happy that she has to do this form. She's in very good health. Sometimes they'll come in and just say, just need to get this form signed. But generally speaking, the patient thinks it's either very quick and easy or a waste of time. But anyway, Dawn's got a fairly sort of standard medical history. And for a GP who's perhaps known Dawn for 10, 20 years, this may be a relatively straightforward thing if you're all across her history. But obviously for the registrar, she's a new patient to them. So the thing that I've certainly observed is if the registrar just goes, yep, okay, driving medical patient says fill in the form, so that's what I'm going to do, I'm going to fill in the form. And certainly I've observed they bring it up on HealthLink, this is in New South Wales, and click through each question, jump to bits of examination as it comes up on the form, get back to history, that sort of thing, tick, 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 sign it off, and off the patient goes. And I think certainly using the form for guidance is certainly not a bad thing, but I think certainly registrars, especially if they're very new, perhaps a bit nervous and just want to get it out of the way, just fill in the form without really thinking, why am I doing this? And I guess if you do have a registrar who comes to you asking, I've got this driving medical, what do I do? Then obviously having that discussion with them about why does the licensing authority care about this patient, and their fitness to drive. So I guess a bit of a, I guess a structure to guide that discussion with your registrar. And essentially we're trying to decide, does our patient have the ability to control the vehicle and act and react appropriately? And obviously, when we're doing the driving medical, we're assessing various functions that are important to the driving task. And I think importantly, certainly the form in New South Wales where I work, and I have to admit I'm not entirely familiar with what the other states' forms are. I couldn't find them online. I don't feel the form by itself is comprehensive enough for a lot of situations. So I think it's, worth that chat with your registrar. Obviously, everyone here has, I'm sure, done many, many driving medicals, but I guess I already alluded to the fact that for us GPs, we've had a relationship with our patients, often for many years. We've been with them through various medical things. We know what's kind of going on. The medical history is kind of almost done and is very sort of quick and easy. But obviously, with registrars who are meeting these patients for the first time, they often don't know and will just. Again, sometimes what I've observed, I don't know if this is the case for you, Simon, or anyone else, is that the patient expects it to be a very quick process. And so certainly if the registrar's kind of checking through the record, okay, what's your diabetes? What's your on? Where's your last test? Da da da. The patient can kind of want to hurry things along. And then sometimes the registrar can feel pressured to hurry things along and just rush through and do the form. And I think importantly, obviously, the medical history is important. It's what's on the New South Wales form. But I think certainly as drivers are getting older, a specific driving history, just encouraging your registrar to ask some questions around how much driving is your patient doing? Are they already kind of limiting their driving because they've got some insight into perhaps some issues? Have they been getting lost? Do they get fatigued? That sort of stuff. And, again, being a patient's regular GP, you may know their children or other relatives have already expressed concerns to you or something like that, which again is information the registrar often won't be privy to.
Just a comment, this assessment should not be given to the registrar without prior briefing by the regular GP.
It would be amazing if that happened in reality.
It's certainly, I wouldn't think, close to universal, but I think it is actually really good practice because, as we're flagging here, there are lots of issues that a registrar may be unfamiliar with.
Brilliant. So just back to our case, and I've just put the sort of main details there again. So your registrar takes a history as you've guided them. What examination do you think they should be doing for Dawn? What would you be telling them to do to assess Dawn's fitness to drive?
But it's on the form, isn't it, Jess? Just a bit of an eye check.
I'm curious to know what's on because I did try, I don't know if it's because everything's online now. I tried to find other state driving forms, but I don't know, I wasn't didn't have much luck. But certainly in New South Wales, the only examination that the form really calls for from memory is visual acuity and fields. And I guess a blood pressure check to make sure that they're not outside of range. But other than that, there's not really
So the Queensland form only assesses eyesight, coordination, range of movement of the neck. Tim, I think, is really important. And yeah, again, curiously, just is not present in terms of what the registrar or ourselves are asked to tick, a cognitive assessment.
And certainly, yeah, your registrars would be well guided by that. And so obviously all of us know that the examination for different patients with different conditions at different ages is going to be different. So this is certainly not saying that this is something that should be done for everybody who needs a driving medical, but I guess I just wanted to highlight that firstly, there certainly is more than visual acuity in fields that the registrars should be doing. And then there's a couple of tests, I guess, more for musculoskeletal function and particularly cognitive function. There's some evidence behind them in terms of their applicability to the patient's safety specific to the driving task. And I think it's interesting, I don't know, Simon, the driving medical that you'd observed where someone had sort of quite severe musculoskeletal impairment and the registrar just went through the form and wasn't aware to kind of check for anything there. And
You're certainly reminding me of a patient that I saw who came in with one leg, as in he literally hobbled in with a sort of crutch and a missing leg and a seeing eye dog. And I thought, oh my goodness. And he was coming for a driving medical. And honestly, I thought, oh, this is a chewy one. I'm not quite sure what happened there. So it is interesting, isn't it? It's almost the form can drive the process. And I guess at this point, I guess it's important to say what we're doing here is talking about a whole bunch of things that potentially are simple and potentially are quick, and it means for an efficient sort of consultation. But we're really trying to point out that, these things are potentially high risk. And if a patient is leaving who does have a cognitive impairment or a motor disorder that we're not assessing fully, it's a significant public health concern.
yeah, absolutely. And I think certainly every single one of these consultations that I've observed in the ECTVs, all by one, followed the form. And the one who didn't follow the form and actually went and did a little bit more copped a lot of flak from the elderly patient because, they were going overboard and interrogating them and all this sort of stuff. Even when the registrar was, I think, doing a really great job. So anyway, I'll talk a little bit more about a couple of these. So in terms of musculoskeletal function and driving safety, is anyone familiar with or do the rapid pace walk as part of a fitness to drive examination?
I have, but only because I heard you present on this about a month ago. But until then, no.
There's lots of different tests that are out there. Like if you were to sort of look at all the articles and everything, there's a lot of different things for testing musculoskeletal function, functional reach and toe tapping and stuff like that. But I like this one. There's a bit of evidence behind it and it's fairly quick, easy, doesn't require any equipment or anything. Essentially, out in the hallway near your room, you just mark out a 3 meter long path and have the patient at one end, and you say, okay, when you're ready, start. As soon as they start, they've got to walk to the tape on the floor, turn around, and walk back to where they started. And basically, as soon as they lift their foot off the floor to first start walking, you start timing them how long it takes. And basically, there's, good evidence behind this that if that walk, and I should mention that if they need a cane or a walk up, that's fine, they can use that. They use whatever they normally use to mobilize. But if it takes them longer than 7.5 seconds to do that 6 meters, so 3 meters there and back, that has evidence that they're at a 2.5 times greater risk of caught, like an at fault motor vehicle accident. And if it takes them longer than 9 seconds, they're at a 3 times increased risk of an at fault motor vehicle accident. So I think that, and I think it's simple, it's quite quick. Just for a bit of a general musculoskeletal assessment. I mean, there are more specific things. I mean, obviously, I think you absolutely have to do neck range of motion and stuff like that. But in terms of something that, you can be confident relates to the driving task, I think this is a great one. In terms of cognitive, so there's a few things that have been tested with the driving task. Some of them are very long and onerous, and I think for the vast majority of GPs would be, just take too much time, like the road sign recognition test and stuff like that. But I think these ones, again, are relatively quick. The familiarity level with these, people know the trail making, or I imagine Snell Grove, maybe people have heard of or possibly use. So basically, the trail making test, there's a part A, which is like a almost a practice where they just have to start at one and as quick as they can, basically join the circles 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, through to 25. Part B, slightly more complicated, start at one and they need to do 1A, 2B, 3C, etc., as quickly as they can. And again, for that, that's been tested in relation to driving. And basically, if it takes them over a certain threshold of time, then that's very concerning, basically, for their cognitive ability in relationship to driving. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you say, yep, you're not fit to drive. Obviously, you make that decision combined with other things, but obviously, you can tell your registrar, look, if they've got this kind of result, then, perhaps the OT driving assessment or something like that is really called for. Similarly, with the Snell Grove, it's really quick. This is the one I tend to use. They get a practice maze, which is very little, just to get the idea of what they're doing first, and then come to this one. And you basically tell them, don't lift your pen off the page, don't cross over any lines or go into any dead ends, and get, through to the end as quick as possible. If you do it yourself, you'll realize it's actually extremely easy. And again, if it takes a patient longer than 60 seconds, that's similarly concerning.
It does sound like there's a bit of familiarity with the, these at
Yeah,
least,
awesome.
Jess.
Awesome.
But
No, that's
having said
good.
that, of course, yeah, registrars
This
are probably highly unfamiliar with these
Yeah,
things.
I think they are. And I think if they get used to doing something like, pick one, like I sort of generally do the maze test, I think it's a really good thing. You can sort of, in a teaching session, do it with them. Like, have a race. How long does this take? Okay, I know that it's not that hard. And get a bit of practice at teaching each other through it so then they can feel confident in administering it, with a patient. Similarly, I'm sure everyone's familiar with clock drawing. Again, that's also been tested specifically against the driving task, and basically anything less than a perfect score is cause for concern. A few things with the driving medical, I think probably the main thing is certainly for your early registrars to have that conversation about not being led by the form. And obviously, if you want to, do some specific teaching with them, we'd encourage that. And there is a teaching plan to help you through that. And just one last little thing I wanted to mention while we're on driving is alcohol interlock programs. Again, they're all slightly different depending on which state or territory you're in. But I think a lot of registrars end up with these patients because they generally have better availability than the long-standing GPs. And if they just don't know it's a thing, I think it's worth just letting them know, look, there's this thing, you should read up about it. But I think, again, it's something that can catch them off guard. And if they're feeling a bit pressured, they may sign something off when they shouldn't have.
Thanks, Jess. But we'll move to the justice script, which was highlighted at the beginning as one of these types of encounters. And here's Barry, and he's come to see your registrar. Again, that context is so important. It can be very straightforward for us as practitioners who have had experience with patients over potentially decades. But for the registrar, every patient's new, and but on the flip side, every patient's a really useful and significant learning experience. And so they're actually doing themselves in the medical education side of things a bit of a disservice by just whipping out a script, as well as probably doing the patient a disservice. So here's Barry. He has a very similar past medical history to our disgruntled driving medical patient. And he's really just after a script. And of course, it's a very straightforward thing to do to print that off and to say, all good. The registrar should be encouraged to gather sufficient information to make a decision as to the appropriateness of prescribing the medication. Clinical decision making with the patient, clearly communicating that, and may require some monitoring and review. And so, as I did very recently in this teaching visit with this registrar, who actually did a very good job of unpacking a number of the prescriptions, we talked about these elements. But it was really revealing. And I said to the registrar afterwards, look, I'm giving this talk to a bunch of supervisors very soon. And with your permission, I'll sort of describe the interaction you've had in a little bit of detail. And, it was, so you're on this particular drug called allopurinol. You know what that's for? No. And so even to explore patient understanding, why are they even on the thing? Are you getting any side effects, do you think, from any of your medications? Indeed, are they working? Is your HbA1c well controlled, or is your blood pressure controlled? Is it still an appropriate medication, or has it just been prescribed 15 years ago and better things have come along, or indeed it could be ceased? Are there any over-the-counter medications? So, in thinking about this talk, I'm very aware that Jess and my role is not to make all these straightforward, simple, and potentially opportunities to catch up when you're running really late, detailed, laborious, overly complex encounters. But I think from a patient safety and from a learning experience, some of these questions can really make it a much better encounter. And of course, then it's the decision around those things and incorporating the patient-centered care as such, communication, monitoring, and review. So if we go back to Barry, and I guess Jess has given a very specific example, this is probably a bit more conceptual and broadly around the approach to re-prescription of medications. You identify that, or that your registrar does, with sufficient support to take a more detailed history and to explore things, that the blood pressure actually is poorly controlled, and it is a recommendation for ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. One of the most common is a fairly routine re-prescription of PPIs. And again, it's very common in clinical teaching visits where I would suggest a registrar maybe talk to the patient around deprescribing or dose reduction, at least of PPIs for GORD, because if it's well controlled and was started 10 years previously. Barry's HbA1c is actually okay, but he's not been taking his tablets much at all because of the GI side effects, and we consider a dose reduction there. His atorvastatin seems to be okay, no change. But as many patients do, he's taking some over-the-counter medications, including very regular ibuprofen for his knee osteoarthritis. And, that is a concern potentially with his ACE, potentially anyway. And, we have a yarn to him and think about some physio review. I really love the expression, there's no such thing as a simple script request, because it's true and it shouldn't be. And it's actually, I think, doing the patient a disservice and certainly doing the registrar a disservice in their learning if they're not exploring some of these. And of course, we know registrars' exposure to older patients to chronic disease is often limited by virtue of their, moving from practice to practice. And so this is a great opportunity, I think, for them to at least get a bit more exposure. But our next patient is a baby check. So another very common scenario.
I thought we'll just discuss a couple of things with the baby check. So this is Mia. She's 6 weeks old. She comes in with both her parents, Kate and Joel. Fairly normal sort of story so far, or not unusual story so far. A couple of days in the nursery for jaundice, probably due to some trauma from a vacuum-assisted delivery. She's breastfed on demand, but she's a pretty unsettled baby, crying a lot, and her parents, that's their concern. In addition to just doing the usual baby check and immunizations today. And I think, obviously registrars can be very varied. Some have done a couple of years of peds training before coming over to general practice, and they'll obviously be much more confident to perhaps that registrar who had to do a bit of extra paperwork and stuff for their peds mandatory term and isn't very experienced at all. And again, I thought the baby check was one because sometimes it can easily be very form led, the way the registrar approaches the baby check sort of appointment and examination. But I just thought a couple of things that I think sometimes registrars struggle with, and perhaps you agree or think there's different things, but this has been my observation. Sometimes it's just right at the beginning, the history. I think some registrars just kind of go, yep, blue book, that's what I've got to do. Immunizations, check that, tick off these, few examination points, and off I go. And depending on where they work, sometimes the nurse may have had more of a chat with the parents, but that's not, I don't think one can assume that. And I guess just a couple of other things that are potential sort of high risk, but again, that the registrar who perhaps isn't very experienced or confident with peds, and I don't know what people sort of tell their registrars about, listening to the heart and that sort of thing. But I think there can be, some registrars want to appear confident and like they know what they're doing, and they just very briefly kind of listen to the heart or feel the pulses, that sort of thing, without really assessing it properly. So certainly when I do this, I tell parents I'm going to be taking a while listening to the heart because I need to spend time zoning in on the sound to hear properly. And I've always, encourage registrars, take your time and let parents know that you're taking your time, and that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the baby. The other one is the palate. I think sometimes this gets missed in checking, and this is, I guess, newborn checks as well when they're, discharged from hospital at 20 hours of age and that kind of thing. But checking the palate both visually, like with a torch and a tongue depressor, as well as through palpation with a gloved finger. And the hips, I think, is another one that's tricky. And if you're not familiar with Don't Forget the Bubbles, I think it's an awesome resource for peds, and they have a nice page and video, that you could direct registrars to on the baby check, which I think is really good.
Particular issues with their registrars struggling in the baby check. One comment was handling the baby, which is interesting, and that whole sense of I haven't done this very much, and even to pick a newborn up and things can be quite confronting because, as you're probably aware, many of our registrars sort of get through their hospital time with fairly limited peds exposure, and handling newborns might be completely unfamiliar to them. So this could be absolutely new territory. Do you have any suggestions on how to help a registrar get confident handling a baby?
That's tricky. I think having your own baby helps with that, but obviously that's not what I'm going to recommend to the random registrar. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess it'd be worth talking to the registrar. Like, are you worried about hurting the baby? Like, I think sometimes, whether it's that or if they're too rough, I don't know. But yeah, that's an interesting one. Hips, again, I'm not going to go, everyone knows how to do Barlow and Ortolani's tests, but I guess, again, something that I've observed is a lot of registrars are trying to do this test well beyond, the age at which it's, I guess, validated or likely to give you reliable results. So even though it can certainly be done in a baby above 8 weeks of age, that window of time, that first 2 months, is when, the results are most reliable. And you may, if you try to do Barlow and Ortolani after that age, there could be a problem, but you don't detect it by using those tests. So I think, letting your registrar know that doing that at 6 months or 12 months may not, certainly not 12 months, isn't going to help. So just a couple of other things, that they can do instead. So the skin folds is, classically known as a soft sign, certainly best observed when the baby's in the prone position. And I guess it's more one that you use as an added sign for potential DDH. And then there's the Galeazzi test, which is where you're basically picking up on, an apparent leg length discrepancy, which could be due to a subluxed or dislocated hip. And the other big one, especially for slightly older babies, which is easy to test, is the hip abduction. And essentially they should be able to, the normal hip in a baby should sort of be able to get their knee all the way over onto the examination bed. And I guess, just letting your registrar know, they're like, okay, I can't do Barlow and Ortolani, what should I do? It's like, okay, well, if you notice that, one of those hips can't go out as much as the other, then that's certainly a sign that there could be something going on. That was all I was going to say about hips. Obviously, me as parents were really worried about crying. I think this is something that can certainly cause a lot of anxiety for GPs and certainly registrars about, is there something serious going on causing the crying? And this is the kind of thing that, registrars will be calling their supervisor about, saying, what should I be doing? Is there something I'm missing? And in Mia's case, you'll have gone through the registrar with the registrar about red flags, what sort of history questions to ask, examination. Again, this comes back to my point about, doing a thorough examination and not just ticking off the blue book. I think it's always really helpful for parents to know that the doctor's had a good look over the bub. But I guess with Mia, we, have decided there's no organic cause, nothing really serious going on. She's growing well, thriving. And so you talk to your registrar about purple crying. I think this is a really good resource for registrars, especially those who maybe haven't had kids themselves, about what is a sort of normal scope of early infant behavior. And you can direct them to the purple crying website, which is also a really useful resource for them to pass on to patients and their parents who are struggling with crying. As I already mentioned, I think, you know, a registrar who's not sure about what's going on with a baby whose parents report they're crying a lot, doing a really thorough examination can help reassure the registrar as well as the patient. And like with so many of these things, encouraging the registrar to keep, you know, good follow-up for the parents and baby, as well as whatever the local supports are in your area for that sort of thing. A lot of parents will come in saying, you know, should we do Invokol or gripe water or whatever? And, you know, basically there's insufficient or, you know, no evidence of benefit for all these things like dietary modification, again, assuming that we've eliminated calcium protein allergy, that sort of thing, anti-reflux medications, you know, any pain relieving agents, certainly not any musculoskeletal manipulation type procedures. There's very limited evidence on specific probiotic for exclusively breastfed infants under 3 months, but that's, yeah, certainly not a really strongly proven thing. So I think that's useful because I think registrars can sometimes want to leap to a fix and they might go, oh yes, I've heard about this Invokol, try that. But, you know, we can tell them that there's no evidence for benefit. And I think it's about supporting the parents with education and, you know, obviously referrals and follow-up that's probably going to be the most useful thing.
Thanks, Jess. So our next and I think possibly final patient in the morning of these so-called simple encounters is for a checkup. And this is Gordon, and he's a tailor, and he's come for a checkup. He has a 3-year history of well-controlled hypertension. He's otherwise really fit and well, and his only medication is that he takes ramipril 5 milligrams a day. 12 months ago, he came in for the same thing, and I did see one of the suggestions as the simple script was the annual bloods or my routine blood test. And this and the other patient are much more sort of broad around rational prescribing initially, and this is more around rational testing. But we'll do it through the prism of Gordon, who 12 months ago had a bunch of bloods and they were all normal, and there's nothing particularly impressive on history, and certainly the previous bloods prior to that were also okay. And he's asymptomatic. He's really come in because he likes to keep himself fit and well, and he just wants to know what could be done by way of a checkup. What aspects of physical examination would you undertake for this 64-year-old, very healthy man who's only got well-controlled hypertension? Or indeed, if we're thinking about this for supporting registrars, the registrar says, look, I don't know what to do. You know, do I feel his belly? Do I check his pulses? Do I try to look in the back of his eyes? I don't know. What would you do? There's not a whole lot of guidance in terms of screening examinations, but there's a little bit of information. And I know we all do different things. I remember assiduously listening to people's carotids, and I would have listened to this man's carotids as a registrar, I'm sure. And I'm not sure if I was taught that or I just thought it was a good thing. And I remember sending quite a few patients off with Brewies that didn't have carotid stenosis. So I kind of stopped, and evidence would support that decision. So, Jess, what sorts of things would people be doing?
So, cardiovascular examinations like blood pressure, pulse, heart, like the heart sounds, I'm guessing, weight check. Someone's mentioned a skin check and checking in on mental health.
Yep.
You know, doing a CVD risk calculation, kidney health, which I'm not sure if they're meaning like blood pressure and dipstick, height, weight, blood pressure. Yeah, so cardiovascular.
Yeah, and so that, in a sense, that's good. Nobody's feeling his abdominal organs or going too sort of extensively in terms of an examination, because we do need to think about these things potentially, as my enthusiastic checking of carotids was leading to, you know, investigations that were probably unnecessary. So what tests would you order on Gordon? Just a reminder, he's 64, he's got high blood pressure, but it's well controlled on treatment. 12 months ago, he had the usual gamut of annual bloods, which I would, if there's a take-home message in this talk, there's no such thing as annual bloods, in my view. Yeah, and so what tests would you suggest he have at this visit? But this is hard, and this is a common scenario. So registrars don't learn about preventative healthcare in hospitals, and they're suddenly encouraged to incorporate that into their consultations, or indeed in this type of presentation, this is it's purely a preventative health interaction.
more on the history about, asking about sleep, diet, relationships, and substances, which is good. FOBT, CMP is calcium, magnesium, phosphate.
The nice thing I like to quote to both patients and registrars when I teach them is that there's about a 40% uptake of the national government program of FOBT testing. So we've got a really, really key role in general practice to complement that. AUCs, this is a man who has is at risk of CKD, obviously with his hypertension. I think that's not unreasonable at all. Full blood count, liver function tests, sugar, lipids. Half of you would do a PSA and smaller numbers of other things. This is difficult, and I think registrars often really struggle to know how to approach this. And there is some evidence and guidance around this, but a lot of it comes down to pressure and patient request and what's been done before and that sort of thing. So I wanted to spend the last 5 or 6 minutes just talking about rational testing and in this case, particularly screening. And I just want to get a little bit theoretical, but I think appropriately so. And this is, again, a really important message and teaching tip that I would encourage you to use with registrars. So often a registrar will come in and say, I've got this patient who's young and they've got really poorly controlled blood pressure on a couple of agents, and I want to screen them for renal artery stenosis. And I know it sounds really pedantic, but that's not screening for anything. That's case finding or investigation. Screening is it's purely asymptomatic people and trying to identify whether they've got something in the background. So we're trying to detect early disease. And I know that sounds really pedantry to say that's not screening, but it actually makes a big difference in the way we should be offering tests and the way we should be interpreting tests. Because, of course, when we think about pretest probability of a test, it's much, much more likely that a test is positive when somebody's got symptoms or at risk of having the disease than if we're just screening the population. So false positives are much more common in a screening group. So that differentiation, which comes from the Red Book, I think is a really important one to make. It follows with this, and I just think this is really interesting and a kind of just a bit of a conceptual thing to consider, that the risks of screening must be carefully considered because the patient hasn't actually asked for it. I mean, they've asked to be checked, but we're actually offering them a bunch of things that is unassociated with their clinical presentation, as in they're not sick, they don't have symptoms. And so very commonly, I see registrars screening patients, as in here's a bunch of tests you can get done without any consent, without any sense of these are the sorts of tests I'm doing or I'm offering you, these are the sorts of things that we're looking for. And of course, this can take a long time, and I wouldn't encourage this, but even a brief discussion of the implications of a test being abnormal, such as a PSA. So I do push this sense of the need for consent when registrars test, and the fact that it's actually even more problematic when it's screening as opposed to investigations. So the RSAGP Red Book has been a very good evidence-based source of guidance for many years, and there's a relatively recent edition of that. And of course, that's about screening. When we think about Gordon, a lot of what we're doing is screening. He does have hypertension, and so some of it is potentially case finding for things that hypertension could lead to. So what does the RSAGP Red Book talk about in terms of a man like Gordon, who's 64? And great to see people thinking beyond the test, because in fact, that's probably where the money is. So SNAP and readiness to change, thinking about depression and screening for that. Interestingly, skin cancer screening by way of a skin check is not routinely recommended in the Red Book. And I know it's very common and often done, and certainly if a patient requests it, we probably shouldn't be trying to talk too many people out of that, but we don't need to routinely do that as part of a check, as in it's not recommended by our guidance. And a family history using the family history screening questionnaire. Weight, height, BMI, blood pressure every couple of years, which I think is too infrequent, but fasting lipids every 5 years if they're at low risk. And that is, to me, that's where we start to talk about the frequency of testing and the problems that over-testing can cause. And if any of you have seen me talk about over-testing, you'll see I can get very passionate about it. And I think we do too many tests. And I think registrars get anxious, and registrars don't want to miss things, and registrars feel they should be offering the patient something. But sometimes this actually causes more harm than good. What else does the Red Book suggest? FOBT every couple of years. Gordon isn't a candidate for cervical screening on mammography, but obviously in the appropriate cohort. Vaccinations, thinking about diabetes with an OSD risk, fracture risk, and cardiovascular risk calculation. And I just wanted to touch on some guidance and also some disease-specific areas that may help you as supervisors. Well, this is going to be very familiar to you, I'm sure, but support your registrars in this endeavor. So there is a brand new, actually in the last few weeks, I think it's been released, set of CKD guidance in primary care in Australia. So if people don't know of this resource, it's excellent. It truly is an excellent resource for clinical practice, and point your registrars to it if they don't know about it. Lots and lots of people in our communities are at risk of CKD, and Gordon is, he's got hypertension, but not everyone. So we don't need to get hugely enthusiastic about doing EECs on everyone if they're not in one of these risk factors. If they're young and healthy and they had a kidney function 12 months ago and they're not at particular risk, you probably don't need to do it. Hyperlipidemia, again, I think we do, and the guidance would suggest we do too commonly. If a patient's less than 10% cardiovascular risk on the absolute cardiovascular risk calculation, we really don't need to be doing their lipids any more than 5 yearly, again, according to guidance. And there may be reasons, but it may be just be habit that a patient comes in every year and they get all their lipids and sugars and everything else done, and there's actually no good clinical indication for it. The caveat here is that for First Nations people, screening with lipids and a sugar should commence from the age of 18, and that's a very, very nice set of guidance that was in the NJA recently on that. For diabetes, similarly, I think we do overtest for diabetes, and the guidance would suggest otherwise. So, if a patient's at high risk, screening with a fasting blood glucose every 3 years. Now, patients are on very commonly completely low risk, asymptomatic people are getting an annual blood sugar. Again, it's not my role here to be critical of anyone's practice, but guidance would suggest that is overtesting. The problem is, of course, this can lead to more testing in a cascade and potential harm. So again, I think a registrar is in a position of great influence, and we can really refine rational test ordering practice in our registrars, particularly if we model it well. And of course, there's loads and loads of tests that really don't appear in the Red Book and really are probably not indicated. And again, I know many of you will do a blood count or a liver function test, but I would be encouraging registrars as a routine to stop and think, what is the indication here? What do you do with a slightly raised transaminase in the non-drinking, non-medication taking patient? Is it going to worry them? Do you have to pursue it? How do you manage that? And in fact, Gordon's not that keen. Seemed to have had a bunch of bloods 12 months ago. Everything seemed to be all right. Yeah, I know I've got the blood pressure. So he walks away with your very rationally ordered investigations. And I hope I'm not being too provocative in saying that, but he has a kidney function, an ACR, and everything can sit tight for a while. But of course, you've also identified that he could probably do with an FOBT if he hasn't had it done. I may finish and not cover skin checks, apart from just point people to a really good resource.
There was a great comment about, the history is much more, useful in terms of figuring out health indicators and then what tests you may do. So.
I just love, as a cyclist, that the cycling lane is obstructed by a sign to say give cyclists space. And I think registrars can emulate this in a sense. I want to do the right thing. I want to be the sign to help protect the cyclists. But in doing so, I'm actually causing harm by ordering all these tests, which I think probably are good for someone. It can lead to false positives and potential problems. So, yeah, a message just around rational testing and how you can support your registrar to do that better. I won't talk about skin checks other than referring you to what was a really nice AJGP article, which talks about some of the evidence around skin checks, and it also reaffirms that routine skin checks in low-risk individuals are not necessary or not recommended, but it describes an approach to a skin check. And I think, again, I remember, and I'm sure you all remember, and I know many registrars have the experience of being asked to do a skin check, which sounds incredibly simple and straightforward, and they have no clue where to start and what to do with those funny spots. And I'm sure you're getting called about that. Well, I think we'll finish up. Just in terms of the resources, we talked about the call for help list. Jess, had a snip from the fitness to drive teaching plan, but there's actually a teaching plan on all these so-called simple encounters that are a bit more complex when you scratch the surface, including rational prescribing and test ordering, health check, antenatal care, although I wouldn't suggest that is relatively simple, workers' compensation forms, a range of things. So again, either use those or refer your registrars to them. Jess, thank you very much for your presentations tonight on two topics that I remember certainly as a registrar really struggling with and at times still do.
Thanks very much for having me.
Really hoping that this has inspired you to think about some of those encounters that we can certainly just think as straightforward and the registrar can manage okay, but actually there's probably a bit behind that and I could spend some time maybe supporting them or at least telling them, you know, when you get in there, it's not as straightforward as just reprinting a script or filling in the form. So thanks very much all. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and/or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, Instagram, or X, formerly Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.